We invite you to stay tuned for a special series of Bible studies on the book of Revelation. Your instructor is missionary and Bible teacher David Long. Yes, this is the Emmaus Bible Hour, a program for you and your family, a time to study the Bible together.
In chapter 12, God gave us a look back to the roots of the conflict between himself and Satan. In chapter 13, we saw the activity of the beast and the false prophet currently in the tribulation, that is, chronologically in its place in the unrolling of the book of Revelation. Now in chapter 14, our eyes are taken ahead to the ultimate victory of Christ over these foes, even though there are some things to be done before this actually historically takes place in chapter 19. Faith sees everything as accomplished, if God says so. Faith gives substance, actual body, to things hoped for but not yet seen, as we read in Hebrews 11. The Lamb is now on center stage on Mount Zion. He has come to earth, as Zechariah and others have foretold many centuries before. Read carefully Zechariah 14, particularly verse 4. But he is not alone. He is surrounded by devoted followers who go with him wherever he goes. Actually, we learn from other scriptures that Christ will be accompanied by many multitudes of his people at this time. Read carefully Revelation 19, verse 14. Jude 1, verse 14, and Daniel 7, verses 11 to 18, and then verse 22, and Colossians chapter 3 and verse 3, and many others. But in our passage, attention is focused on one particular company, the 144,000 witnesses who had been sealed previously, because now they have emerged victorious over the worst that Satan and his two representatives on earth could do throughout the horrors of the Great Tribulation. From this opening movement, we have a development worthy of study. In verse 14, Christ appears as Son of Man, his title of judgment, seated on a white cloud, glory. He is crowned, the victorious one coming to rule. And he has a harvesting sickle in his hand, symbol of sharp, swift execution of his opponents. Before him chronologically appear three angels, and following him three more, each one of these with a message. The first angel, who is called another angel to distinguish him from the series of angels who have already blown the trumpets, flies with a message which is everlasting. That is, it has no limits of time or locality. The message gives three basic points. 1. God must be feared. 2. God must be glorified. 3. God must be worshipped, which in Scripture always includes the dedication of what we are and have to him. As is pointed out in the printed lesson material, the whole cunning and power of the beasts will be exerted to blot God from men's minds, to make them fear, glorify, and worship the man of sin, the great super dictator. This now is a call and a challenge from heaven, that God demands these, that is, worship, fear, and glory, from his creatures for himself. It is interesting and instructive to notice that in the great head-on clash of the last months of this age, the test will be who or what men worship. Worship is, in other words, the final issue. It is important to keep this in mind because in our day, many even sincere, well-meaning Christians belittle worship and say that the important thing is to work for God and to win men. The Bible clearly says that in this age, as in all others, God seeks worshipers. The second angel, verse 8, comes proclaiming the fall of Babylon, here mentioned for the first time, but later dealt with in detail in chapters 17 and 18. This, of course, is the great world church of Christendom, as distinguished from Christianity. The consummation of the ecumenical movement, the center of a so-called worship which does not give Christ his true place, and therefore is the center of false worship. Her moral and spiritual unfaithfulness is here called fornication, for which the Old Testament punishment from God was death. The third angel carries on the developing message by pronouncing God's judgment on the worship of the beast, the world ruler. God is here reaffirming the solemn prohibition laid down at Mount Sinai against the worshipping, serving, or giving of our devotion to anything or anyone but himself. Most earth dwellers or worldlings, to say nothing of many Christians, either deny, ignore, or forget that God insists on this, both for Jews and Gentiles throughout the Scripture. In Deuteronomy 11:16, this is called, that is, worshipping anything else, is called turning aside, or in modern language, getting off course. And they are there warned that this will bring the violent punishment of God down upon them. This is emphatically laid down also in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 19. And in both passages, we are told that such a path leads to destruction. That is, a path of leaving off worship to God. This refers to the people of Israel, of course, but in Romans chapter 1, where the great apostle to the Gentiles, Paul, is tracing in a most incisive way the path of non-Jewish nations down to destruction, he says, inspired by God, of course, that the first step was, read chapter 1, verse 21, that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. Note that word glorified, which is used in our passage in Revelation, and that here in Romans it is connected with the words of as God, while we are told that the beast shows himself in the temple as God, saying that he is God and claiming honor for himself. In Romans chapter 1, they go on to worship and serve images of created things, right down to crawling reptiles. And of the same people, it is said in chapter 3, verse 18, there is no fear of God before their eyes. So we have the three precise words of condemnation mentioned in Revelation 14, all dealt with in Romans chapters 1 and 3. So the original issue was one of owning and acknowledging God, and the final showdown will come on that point too. And in the messages of the first three angels, we have all three points made clear. One, that God demands for himself the fear, the glory, and the worship of his creatures. Two, that Babylon, the great center of false worship, will be judged. And three, that all who worship the beast instead of God will have this judgment executed upon him. See also chapter 15, verse 4, for the same three words occurring in the same order. Next we see the vision of Christ on a cloud of glory, crowned and with a sharp harvesting sickle in his hand, to carry all this promised retribution into actual effect. The patience of the saints in verse 12 refers to the fact that they have suffered unresistingly and patiently, committing their cause to God and leaving it to him to choose the time for the settling of accounts. Following the vision of Christ coming on the cloud in judgment, we have three more angels, a second set of three, each one with a message quite distinctive, and yet related each one to the other. Number 4, in verse 15, announces that not only is there to be just punishment, but that the time has actually arrived. The time is come for thee to reap. Verse 17 shows that angel number 5 comes with a sickle, just like Christ, to assist him in the work of judgment. This angel, or messenger, is possibly symbolic and representative of all those saints and angels who will participate with Christ in putting things right on earth. In Daniel 7, verse 22, to which reference has already been made, we read that not only will the saints come with Christ when he appears, but they will take an active part in the actual judgment. They judge. They possess the kingdom. They reign. So in the New Testament, Paul says, the saints shall judge the world. And again, if we suffer, we shall also reign. And of yet another group, it is said that they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Angel number 6 in verse 18 comes from the altar with power over fire. That is, from the altar he brings authority and power to pour out the fire of God's judgment on his enemies. This must be linked with chapter 6, verse 9, where, at the opening of the fifth seal, a vision is given of the souls of the martyrs of the tribulation under the altar. That is, they are covered by the value of the altar and its sacrifice. But the altar is much more than this. These martyred saints are praying that their death might be avenged. The monstrous wrong of it all must be put right, and God is listening to their prayers, and God promises that this shall in fact be done. Then in chapter 8, verse 3, at the opening of the seventh seal, which will bring the final strokes of direct divine intervention on the earth, we see an angel standing by the altar again with a golden censer. Incense is given him to offer along with the prayers of all the saints. And in verse 5, this in turn is mixed with fire and cast on the earth, bringing voices, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake, all the beginnings of the real judgments of God. So we see the altar connected with the prayers of God's suffering people, which, when accepted and mixed with fire, bring on, in the hand of the angel, swift retribution to the world. Here in chapter 14, the sixth angel is he who has the power of that fire on the altar. It is worthy of note, too, that in chapter 9, verse 13, at the sounding of the sixth angel, a voice pronouncing a very special step in punishment comes from the horns of the golden altar before God. The prayers of the suffering people of God are answered in action in God's own time. In verse 18 of our chapter 14, the angel before the altar who had previously said that the time had not yet come for the answering of their prayers, now says, "Harvest the grapes of the earth, for they are fully ripe." God's time had at last come.